Welcome to Leonard Lopate Weekend, where we bring you three of our favorite segments from the last week in case you missed them. You can find all of our segments on the WNYC app, our website at WNYC.org, or on iTunes. Just search for Leonard Lopate. And of course, you can also listen to us live on the radio every weekday starting at noon.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
A new film called The United Kingdom tells an incredible story, and it's all the more powerful when you realize that it actually happened. How many love stories, after all, have played a role in changing the course of African history? It stars David Oyelowo as Seretse Khama of Botswana, and Rosamund Pike as Ruth Williams, the white woman who caused an international crisis when they decided to marry in the 1940s. The film opens here in New York tomorrow, and I'm delighted to welcome David Oyelowo back to our show, along with director Ama Asante. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
How did you first learn about this real-life story behind the film? Is this something that's been written about a lot?
Well, for me, this first came my way in 2010 while I was doing a film in Atlanta. A producer on that film had the rights to a book called Calabar that was written by Susan Williams, and handed it to me, wondering if I had any interest in maybe playing the role.
A long time ago.
It was a long time ago, but I didn't know about the story, and I was shocked that I didn't once I got to read about them.
And Ama, it's surprising, isn't it? Because there were a lot of headlines at the time in the late 40s, mm-hmm. and it involved the actions of the South African government, which was just instituting apartheid, and also two major British prime ministers, Clement Attlee and Winston Churchill.
Absolutely. I mean, I think in many ways, David and I were both embarrassed that we hadn't come across the story before, we hadn't heard of it. But I think this was also a very uncomfortable time in British history. It was a very sort of embarrassing time in British history. And I remember when we were doing the early test screenings of the film in the UK, one of the strongest reactions that came back in terms of the audience was that, you know, they loved the movie, they loved the drive of the love story, but they felt a little embarrassed by it. And strangely enough, that went over my head. I thought, embarrassed? What do they mean? And then I realized that it was part of their history. It was something that they didn't know about, but also the actions that unfolded.
And Attlee and Churchill are both beloved characters.
They are.
Although Britain was a very different place, racism, when I studied in London in 1960, and I would look for a room, there would be signs that would say, colored need not apply.
Yes.
As a New Yorker, I was shocked, not that there wasn't racism right here in New York City.
Yes, and not to make excuses for Britain, but in terms of certainly Attlee, the Labour Prime Minister's case, Britain was also a different place in 47 because it was only 2 years post-war. It was poor. You know, Britain was pulling itself up by the bootstrings, the economy was struggling, and South Africa had a big impact on Britain's economy. And Attlee had been given a mandate by the people to take care of their future and to take care of their world. And so he had to balance that with the needs of this couple.
David, how soon did this project begin after you'd finished starring as Martin Luther King Jr. in Ava DuVernay's Selma?
We shot this in the
2015, towards,
yeah,
summer
2015.
Of yeah.
So it was the following year that we started shooting it. And, you know, the intervening 7 years between now and when it first came my way, one of the biggest struggles was that I, as an actor, didn't have the level of notoriety that would enable financiers or anyone who was interested in mounting the film to back it. And Selma definitely changed things from that point of view, to the point whereby the same production company, Pathé, who made Selma, also made A United Kingdom.
Amma, didn't you give David his first job in television a while back?
Well, I have to confirm this with David now, because I've said it often and I have to confirm it. Was it your first job in TV?
It was one of. It was actually my second.
My very second
TV job. But it was my first job out of drama school.
That's what I thought.
It was while I was still at drama school. But yes, this was my first job out of drama school.
And had you kept in touch over the years?
Yeah, we had. And, you know, and I'd kept a track of what Amma was doing on that first project we did together, a TV show called Brothers and Sisters.
It was my first writing that was broadcast as well, Brothers and Sisters.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Because Amma had been an actress before that, a child actor, I guess I would describe you as.
Yes.
And then she was the writer, one of the writers on this show. And I actually didn't know she had aspirations to direct until I saw her wonderful film, Belle, and was completely blown away by what she achieved in that. And that's really one of the things that made me convinced that she would be great for this.
Well, David now has star power, but you also snagged Rosamund Pike for the part of Ruth.
We did. Who has her own star power, of course. And Rosamund was just coming off of the back of an Academy Award nomination for her role in Gone Girl. And, you know, and we're three Brits, all who had sort of carved out some pathway for ourselves in Africa. We move within the same circles. It was sort of a no-brainer to show this script to Rosamund, particularly since she and David had worked together previously.
In what?
Yes, we'd done a film called Jack Reacher together and had a very different kind of relationship in that one. In fact, I think I'd tase her in a lift at one point. in that film.
As you do.
But, you know, I'd always admired her as an actress and felt that, you know, for this role, ideally for me, playing Soretse Khama and playing someone who falls in love with this woman quite quickly, you needed someone that had those enigmatic qualities that would make that feel plausible.
I'm speaking with David Oyelowo, who stars as King Soretse Khama of Botswana in a new film called United Kingdom, and also with the film's director, Amma Asante. It opens tomorrow at the Angelica Cinema 123 and at the AMC Lincoln Square. Relatively early on, Soretse reveals to Ruth that his true identity is that he's next in line to be the king of Botswana, and he expects her to break off with him, but she's not deterred. Do you think she expected all the troubles that would ensue?
I don't think so. I think if the two of them had had a chance to really think about it, possibly neither would have moved forward. I think the beauty in some ways, but also the issue that was problematic for this couple, was that they were compelled by this love, and it meant that they were existing in a bubble to a certain extent until that bubble was popped when they arrived in Africa.
Race isn't the only discrepancy here. He is in line to be the king of a country in Africa, and she's a London office worker.
There's a huge class issue here, and it's kind of one that David and I both love, the idea that in this story we kind of flip the script. You know, he is the one of higher class and status, if you like, and she's the one who's a South London girl, something I relate to very much because I'm a South London girl. And yes, in fact, she's marrying up. And I remember flying to Botswana one day and speaking to a young woman from Botswana who said, yes, you know, our first president, he married royalty. And I had to say, no, she married royalty.
One doesn't often see the portrayal of a white person trying to be accepted in the black world.
No.
Yes, and of course it happens all the time. I mean, that's one of the things about this story, is that it shows a side of life generally that we don't get to see. You know, we get to see an African leader who actually loves his people. We get to see a black man who is very committed to his wife and his family. As you say, we get to see a white person seeking acceptance from an African community. These are things that, of course, exist, but so often don't get aired in film. Mm-hmm.
Do you see this as a British story or an African story?
It's both. And, you know, that's why, for me personally, Amma is such a kindred spirit in terms of us doing this film. You know, we are both British, both born in the UK, but both of African descent. My parents are from Nigeria, her parents are from Ghana. And as a result, we identify with both continents, both places.
Mm-hmm. And when you were growing up, did you both go back and forth? I know you did, David.
Yeah.
Yes, I did. I lived in Nigeria for 7 years, and I know that you spent time in Ghana.
I mean, I spent time in Ghana, not living there, but regularly spending time because both my grandparents were there. And, you know, of course, the story of the immigrant is one of leaving their parents behind and, you know, sometimes only being able to see that parent a handful of times. So my mother wanted to make sure that I knew my grandmothers.
What about culture shock? Because that's also part of this story in this film.
You know, what I love, the beauty about this is that as Africans, we're often having to remind people that Africa is a continent, not a country, and that there are various countries within it. And, of course, I'm a victim of it to a certain extent myself, because as I was flying over to Botswana for the first time, I thought, oh, this is going to be great. You know, I know Africa. I've spent a lot of time in Ghana, and I get there, and it's completely different in many ways. Of course, there are some similarities, but Botswana has its own identity. It has its own landscape. It has its own character.
Partly because it was not a colony, it was a protectorate.
Mm-hmm.
What is the big significant difference there?
Well, Botswana, as it's now called, it was called Bechuanaland back then. The reason it was a protectorate...
Bechuan, something like that?
Yes, exactly. It was partly because it was the second poorest country in the world at the time. It had no known mineral resources. The landscape is very flat. I think colonies tended to be countries very rich in minerals.
Wealthy.
Countries that, to be perfectly frank, could be exploited, and Botswana needed protection from South Africa, which was it was trying to be annexed by. That's why they sought the protection of Great Britain.
It was sort of the worst of two evils, to be honest with you. They were trapped in a situation where, as Susan puts it so brilliantly in the book Calabar, either to be ruled by the white British or the white African, and they chose the white British.
If the British government didn't endorse South Africa's recently instituted apartheid laws, why would they want to interfere with this marriage and with the ascension to the throne?
Huge reasons. As I say, Britain was poor, and South Africa was offering cheap gold, which was underlining, you know, the UK economy at the time. But we were sort of entering into a Cold War, and South Africa was also offering cheap uranium that Britain needed for its atomic bomb program. So there were very, very practical reasons that Britain needed to, if you like, appease South Africa.
And they were also threatening to leave the Commonwealth if Britain didn't adhere to what they wanted. So, you know, in many ways, Ruth and Seretse were collateral damage.
The people who were running South Africa at this point had supported Germany during World War II.
But Dr. Mellon, who was the leader at the time, was also instituting apartheid. And there were very clear rules as it pertains to race. And so to have a Botswanan king with a white queen over the border was not going to help that agenda.
There were countless reasons and countless times that either of this couple could have given up on their relationship, but they never did. And to make the film work, one has to believe in their love. How do you go making it real for the audience, Hama?
I think it starts first and foremost with the story and the script. You know, the script has to give the actors, you know, viable, believable lines and a set of circumstances and a sequence of events and scenes that make that work. Secondly, of course, it's casting and trying to find casting that would create a dynamic. Of course, David had some sense of Rosamund, which already helped. But then it's as I say, it's about creating a setup of scenes that support that dynamic and will allow an audience to believe in it. Because, of course, in this film, if you don't believe in that dynamic, the whole film crumbles.
I'm speaking with Hama Asante, who directed a new film called A United Kingdom, which opens tomorrow at the Angelica Cinema 1, 2, and 3 and the AMC Lincoln Square, and with David Oyelowo, who stars as King Seretse of Botswana, then
Bechuanaland.
We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with David Oyelowo, who stars as King Seretse of Botswana in a new film called A United Kingdom that opens tomorrow at a number of theaters around town. Also with us is Hama Asante, who directed. How do you prepare for a part like this? Was there any footage of this couple?
Yes, thankfully there was. They were one of the most famous couples in the world post the Second World War. And so there's lots of newsreel footage. There's also some great recordings of him. But, you know, what tends to happen with these kind of historical figures who have a political element as part of their story is you only get to hear recordings of them doing public speaking. You know, it's giving a speech or a news interview. So, you know, you use those things and you're trying to sort of cobble together who they are behind closed doors, because any film worth watching about a historical figure, of course, explores who they are beyond the cameras and beyond the microphones. And so, you know, that was one of the challenges with this.
I'm sure you were helped a lot by the fact that he was Oxford educated, so you didn't have to play too much with accents.
Well, he had a Botswana accent spliced with the King's English, so to speak. So that actually made it a bit tricky, because even the modern day Botswana accent has the American English accent as its base because of the influence of now movies and TV. But back then, it was the radio. It was the BBC World Service. So, you know, I had to be quite fastidious with making sure I built it correctly.
You filmed it on location, at least the Botswana scenes in Botswana.
Yeah.
Were you able to find any people who'd known the couple?
Yes. Not only to be able to find people who knew the couple, but their children and their grandchildren who reside in Botswana. And that was absolutely fascinating. Their son is currently the fourth democratically elected president of Botswana. But the family is rather large. And so we were able to interact with them. We were able to show them images from our research that they had never seen before. It was wonderful.
I don't want to get into how we wind up with elected officials, because that would be a spoiler to some degree.
A little bit.
Yeah, but it's an interesting history, and it's interesting how history had to adjust itself to this situation.
Yes.
Hadn't you just finished making Belle when you started on this film?
Somewhat.
Are you specializing in historical dramas?
Somewhat. Yeah, I had just finished promoting Belle both in the US and in the UK when David called me up one evening. I think that's precisely the reason David thought of me, to be honest with you. Belle was both a sort of intimate story set against a larger political landscape, but it was a love story. It was a sweeping love story, and it was a period piece. And I suppose I'd established myself in David's brain as someone who could handle those pieces, and that's definitely what this film required.
It's also worth saying as well that, yes, you know, Amma's indisputable talents were displayed in that film, but I do think it matters who gets to tell what story.
Yes.
And her perspective was one that I desperately felt we needed for this film. The fact that she is both of British birth and African origin meant that there was a comprehensive view of what this story should be. So often these kind of films have had very much an outsider perspective, and that of course affects who gets to be the protagonists in these stories and the point of view within those stories. I love the fact that Amma is also an unashamed romantic. I knew that about her regardless of her filmmaking prowess, and that was something that we also felt we needed for this film.
Were the 1940s easier to portray than the 18th century?
No, they were more difficult, in honesty, because the 18th century is so far away from where we are today. The costumes are so very different. And the difficulty, I think, here, I'm a purist. So on screen, I want only pure elements that pertain to the period.
But you don't want it to look like a museum piece.
I don't want it to look like a museum
piece. The cars can't be all shiny.
Exactly, exactly. So kind of creating that balance where yes, you understood that there were elements that exist today, that we use today, that existed back then, is okay, but always making sure that it came in the context of that period. It was quite a difficult balance to get when it's so easy to just define the 18th century from now.
Now, you said that Botswana was the second poorest country in the world in 1948 when this story pretty much begins. What is it? How is it now? Because you shot there. Was it difficult making a movie?
No, I mean, it's worth saying that it's the very first feature film ever shot in Botswana. And we were very keen to shoot there because, you know, there's just something indisputable to be gained by, from an authenticity point of view, in shooting in the actual place the events took place. But modern-day Botswana is one of the success stories of Africa, partly because of the lessons Ruth and Seretse learned through their struggles. They kept ownership of their resources, which went on to be discovered beyond the challenges they faced. Very many African countries didn't do that, partly because the colonialist regimes who left still kept a handle on those resources.
Absolutely.
But Seretse was very keen to make sure that his people benefited from their own resources.
Well, it's also just lucky that they discovered those resources just around this time, and they hadn't already been established. People weren't already saying, this is mine.
Yes. Yeah. And it was very clear that the British absolutely believed that Botswana land was barren, and that made a huge difference, I think.
So when it was discovered that it actually had very valuable natural resources, Botswana was already on the way to becoming independent.
I absolutely am convinced that if those diamonds had been discovered in the 20s or 30s, Botswana land would have been a colony, and this story would have gone very differently.
The story hinges on one scene in particular where there's an open community meeting, and Seretse must persuade his subjects to accept him as their king, but also to accept his bride. Could you tell us about the challenges of filming that scene?
I mean, first and foremost, we were using, you know, the real number of extras that you see in the scene. And these were members of the local community who had never been in a film before.
How many were we talking about?
Thousands.
A lot more than you wound up using in Selma. Oh, that was being used in Selma.
Yes.
Thousands.
Yeah, absolutely.
And because they hadn't, you know, not been in a movie before, you know, that it's essential that we create in the film a dynamic between Seretse and his people. And so David had to give that performance, in a sense, to a world of people watching who did not necessarily know how to interact in a scene. So it was important for him to be able to create the end vision in his mind of what it was he was trying to portray, which, you know, he did brilliantly, but it was tough.
And you couldn't use a microphone.
No, that's where having done theatre comes into play. It was all about projecting it so that all those people could hear me.
And trying to get him to save his voice for the key moments, you know.
How aware were you of the close-ups during one pivotal scene? This tear suddenly slides down your cheek. Was that movie magic?
It was, to a certain extent. You know, I think what happened in that, well, I don't think, I know what happened in that moment for me is that every now and again you have the privilege to play a character where there is an overlap between what you believe as a human being and who the character you're playing is. And in that speech in particular, everything Seretse says, I agree with, I live my life by, has been the philosophy that I adhere to. And so I just think in that moment, it was a culmination of getting this film made, being in that place, what I was saying, and how much I believe in it.
Didn't we have a
But you're not a method actor.
Sorry?
You're not a method actor, but that's kind of
I'm method-ish. I'm method light, shall we say. You know, and when you're a producer on a movie, it's hard to kind of go around being in character the whole time. But no, I mean, you know, you stay in a certain zone. I do anyway when I'm doing a character like this. And this was a very, very important film for us to get to tell this story. It means so much to us as people. And so, you know, every day it was we were there in the pursuit of truth.
Amma, you wanted to add to that.
Oh, no, I was saying, didn't we have a spontaneous sandstorm after that moment? We had a bright, you know, quite lovely day, and it was almost as if the heavens and the universe sort of conspired in that moment to react to David's incredible performance, and we ended up having a sandstorm and having to end filming.
And someone actually said after a speech like the one I was giving that day that a similar thing had happened where it started raining, and literally I gave this speech and this sandstorm whipped up, the clouds grayed over, and you know, this guy who was very aware of the history said something similar had happened. So we were very happy to take that as a sign.
Divine intervention.
Indeed.
My guests are David Oyelowo, who stars as King Tseretse Khama of Botswana in a new film, A United Kingdom, directed by Ama Asante, who's also here. It opens tomorrow in theaters around town. Do you think that either of this couple were bitter about what they were forced to endure?
I think that's the incredible thing. From my point of view, I couldn't find any evidence that showed that they were bitter. On the contrary, they seemed to focus very, very heavily on their present and their future once they were allowed back to Botswana land, and dedicated their lives to, of course, their love, but also to other people, the community around them and the society that they wanted to build. And I think that's also what makes them inspirational and heroic.
I found in my research that there's very clear evidence that Ruth really helped Tseretse not become bitter.
Wow.
Her love for him and how dedicated to him and his country she was really, really helped him to stay away from that very natural and human tendency.
Mm. Did it help that your wife is also on the film, Jessica Oyelowo?
Well, it was very ironic that she plays a racist in the film, considering we've been married for 18 years in our own interracial marriage. But, you know, for obvious reasons, it's a story that means a lot to us. So it was a huge privilege to get to share the experience of making the film with her.
Were there problems when you married her? Has England gotten past that?
Certainly nothing like what they went through. But there's actually a scene in the film that Amma and I discussed, and I think is, you know, partly inspired by and certainly was in my head when we were doing it. You know, my wife and I, early on in our marriage, were on a train, and these three guys took umbrage with the fact that a black man was with a white woman and tried to beat me up on the train station, and my wife intervened and said, "Don't you dare touch him." And I couldn't believe who this woman was. We got married when she was 20, and there she was standing up to these three burly guys. And you know, we see a scene not dissimilar to that in our film, so that was definitely a moment of overlap. But we didn't have nations and continents coming up against our marriage.
Were you bullied when you were a kid?
I was, actually. I was in school. I was a very good student, and there were those who felt that wasn't the way to be. But my dad was very good at instilling self-awareness and a sense of self in me, and so you know, I was able to overcome that.
And growing up in London, Amma, did you feel mostly British?
I did, to a certain extent, but it was challenged on a regular and, I would say, almost daily basis. Growing up in Britain in the 70s, it was, I want to say, it was quite different to where it is now, although I'm still trying to work out where we're going now. Mm. We lived as one of only two black families on the street, and it's interesting that we deal with both class and race in A United Kingdom, and I often try to in my films, but it was very clear that race wasn't the only issue that we had. My father was one of the only people on the street that also owned his home, and that made a difference.
Although race has played a role in the decision to vote for Brexit.
I think so. You know, many people deny that. Many people say it has nothing to do with race at all. I would argue that it does. And we have seen changes that involve the way people approach race since Brexit in the UK.
David, of the past 10 films that you've been in, 5 have been directed by women. Is this just a coincidence?
It's not a coincidence. It's absolutely premeditated, and
is it different working with a woman director?
It is different. It is different. And in the same way that if you asked, is watching a woman protagonist in a film different to a male protagonist? Or, you know, men and women are different, but both points of view are valid, especially when it comes to a medium as influential as film. And so, you know, to have a woman direct this film is something I'm very, very proud of, because I think Amma's perspective on this film is one that, you know, the world is malnourished for not seeing more of.
You've said that working with female directors has made you a better actor.
It has, because I think, you know, certainly it's my experience that women are quicker to go to what's going on from a human emotion point of view. And at the end of the day, with storytelling, what are we doing if we're not exploring human emotion and the depths of it? Also, I find in the films I do, a lot of the time, the female characters are paid short shrift. They are less dimensional. And when it's a woman directing, of course, they're not going to allow that to happen on their watch. And if as a male protagonist or as a male character, I'm getting to interact with more dimensional characters generally, but women specifically, of course, it's going to make for a better film.
Although it doesn't hurt that Rosamund Pike is playing Ruth.
And you have a brilliant actress in the form of Rosamund Pike, but I can tell you for a fact that, you know, it's Amma's fastidiousness in making sure that her portrayal was not only three-dimensional in the realizing of it, but on the page, that gave her the tools to be as good as she is in the film.
Amma, you've just finished shooting your next project, Where Hands Touch. What's that about?
Yes, I have. Where Hands Touch is another passion project. It's taken me over 12 years to get off the ground, and it's set in 1944 Berlin, and tells the story of the biracial children known as the Rhineland, or Hitler's problem, the Rhineland children, who existed under the Third Reich. Oftentimes we don't think of people of colour as existing in Germany during the period of the Holocaust, but they very much did.
You started as a child actor. How did you wind up being a screenwriter and a director?
Well, I'm very happy to say that as a child actor, I had absolutely no talent whatsoever. and I knew how bad I was. But what I did have, what I was very good at, was being able to pinpoint a great performance and a great actor. I was in a very powerful high school drama that showed me what the power of a story was. And so when I was old enough to make decisions for myself, I knew I didn't want to leave the industry. I knew I wanted to be part of it. But I wanted to be part of it in a way where I could harness the power of a good performance and a good story.
And Amma Asante has directed United Kingdom, which opens tomorrow at the Angelica, at the Cinema 1, 2, and 3, and the AMC Lincoln Square. It stars David Oyelowo as King Seretse Khama of Botswana, at that time, Botswana Land. And my great thanks to you both for being on our show.
Such a pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much.
Have you ever left a medical exam feeling that your doctor didn't really listen to you? Have you ever switched physicians in search of someone you felt would be more caring? Danielle Ofri has given a lot of thought and study to the communication problems between doctors and their patients, and her new book, What Patients Say When Doctors, What Doctors Hear, probes what goes wrong in the exam room, the impact that it has on the care we get, and what both doctors and patients can do to improve those exchanges. Danielle Ofri is a physician at Bellevue Hospital, a professor at NYU School of Medicine. Her book is published by Beacon Press, and I'm very pleased it has brought Dr. Ofri back to our show. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Why do you say the conversation between doctor and patient is the most important diagnostic tool of all?
What the patient brings to the doctor is really their story, what's been happening, what they feel. And for the doctor to make the diagnosis, it's really how the patient describes the story. And if we don't listen carefully, we miss the most important clues and end up ordering unnecessary tests, going down the wrong diagnostic paths, and are often prone to medical error.
Does it matter whether it's our regular doctor or someone that we're seeing at a clinic or at an emergency room?
For every situation, even specialties that are visually based, like dermatology or orthopedics that are physically based, still the patient's story of how the situation came to be makes a big difference in what the diagnosis is.
Why do many patients, when they're asked about it later, not know the name of their own diagnosis or even the name of the doctor?
Seems amazing, isn't it? But patients are receiving so much information in a visit. Their diagnosis, the test, the workup, the possible situations, referrals, that it's hard to remember, especially if you're in pain, if you're sick, if you're worried, nauseous, freezing. It's often hard to remember everything the doctor says.
Do the doctors have any idea about this lack of knowledge?
I think we do know. We understand that, for example, something like less than half of patients take their medications as directed. So we know that even though we think we're giving the information clearly, that it's not always getting across.
Doesn't communication start a breakdown even before the visit begins, when the patient has to wait a long time before being able to see the doctor?
Sure. I mean, by the time the patient gets there, they've often waited a week, sometimes months for the appointment, then an hour or longer in the room, and they're anxious and nervous. So it already breaks down before we even start.
And then the doctor usually starts the consultation by asking the patient, what brings you here today? How do patients typically respond to that question or try to respond?
Well, patients usually start with something like, you know, I've been having this pain in my stomach. But then we doctors, we interrupt within about 10 seconds and start running down the path of when did it start, how long have you had it, and the patient may not have gotten out the second thing that's on their mind, which may be the most important thing, and our tendency to interrupt. And I think it's not because we're trying to be rude. We want to be efficient and get the patient down the right track, but we often can miss the most important information.
So while patients want to explain their illness as a story with a plot and start at the beginning, how do doctors explain their illnesses, especially since they don't seem to be all that patient enough to listen to the complete story?
Well, doctors often, as the patient speaks, quickly categorize what's going on very rapidly, make a quick diagnosis, and already start onto the plan. I mean, I think most doctors tend to run ahead to what needs to be done. Here are the 16 things that need to be done. Let's get on them now. We may have missed what the patient was really trying to say.
Is it helpful or off-putting when a patient arrives for a doctor visit with a list of questions?
Depends how many questions. So I think that having a list of questions helps, but you need to be realistic. If you have 40 items on your list, you'll only get a superficial treatment of each one. So I tell patients, yes, make a list, but be realistic. You can really only do two or three of in any sort of depth.
Often pertinent medical information can be personal and even embarrassing. How can doctors overcome the patient's reluctance to discuss matters like that?
Well, the most important thing, I believe, is establishing a very comfortable, trusting relationship. So, for example, when we first talk to a patient, to make full eye contact, even just for a minute, rather than go to our computer and start writing, gives a chance the patient to be heard. And often I find that when I go do the physical exam, when I'm away from the computer and we're actually touching and talking without the intrusion of technology, that's when patients feel comfortable saying what's really on their mind. Sometimes the more embarrassing things or uncomfortable things come out at that moment.
But you also say that there's a hand-on-the-door phenomenon where patients wait until the moment that they're leaving the office to bring up the most important issue.
Probably because doctors haven't made the environment receptive enough. But the patient feels they have to get this out. And so it only happens as they're about to walk out into the real world and leave this one last chance with the doctor. And it's a very common phenomenon.
Aren't there many issues that affect patient health that aren't traditionally thought of as medical, like emotional stress or financial problems? Are doctors equipped to even address them?
I think that we at least need to acknowledge them. For example, if a patient isn't taking their medication because it costs too much, we need to know that. And the patient may be embarrassed to admit that, but if we're not aware, we wouldn't know to prescribe a different medication. So while we can't solve the socioeconomic issues, being aware of what's adding to the patient's difficulty in getting treatment is very key for us.
Are doctors unaware of how expensive pharmaceuticals are these days?
Well, we know they're expensive, but we often have no idea what a given patient pays, which insurance plan covers what needs prior approval, what's first tier, second tier. We can't keep track of that. No one can.
How did you eventually realize why your patient Gaspar Navarro wasn't taking his medications properly, even though you'd clearly labeled them for him?
This was a patient I had with difficult-to-control diabetes, and every visit he would come back not taking his meds, and I would make a clear list, write it better, clearer. It took more than a year for him to admit that he couldn't read, and I had no idea because I'd never asked, and he was too embarrassed to admit that.
But you were spelling it out for him, weren't you?
Well, I was writing down the names and making a list. And, of course, if he couldn't read, he couldn't necessarily match it up. And And I realized that I was missing the most important reason why he couldn't take his medications.
My guest is Dr. Danielle Laufrie. Her latest book, What Patients Say, What Doctors Hear, it's from Beacon Press. This is WMYC, WMYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. The issue of time in the exam room comes up repeatedly in your writing here. Do doctors tend to have less time than they used to?
I think we have about the same amount of time, but there's so much more to address in a visit. On the one hand, patients in general are just sicker. There are more chronic illnesses, so much more to deal with. There's also
Why are there more chronic illnesses? Because people are getting older?
Well, people are living longer. People used to die much younger of a heart attack or a stroke or an infection, but now we treat these illnesses, so people live longer with their chronic diabetes and hypertension. On the other side, we now have much more to document in the visit. The electronic medical record, which helps in many respects, also can add many requirements. We must address pain scores and depression, education level, language barriers, asthma action plan, HIV screening, all of which are very important, but make it very difficult to get everything done in the narrow amount of time.
So a doctor has to figure out how to best use the time that he or she has?
So we have to prioritize just like the patient. And I may choose to focus on one particular part of my patient's conditions on this visit because I can't get to it all. It will help if I say, hey, today, let's focus on your blood pressure and let's leave, you know, the cholesterol and the diabetes, you know, for the next time we get together, or let's focus on your diet and exercise.
But in many cases, aren't you seeing a patient one time?
Well, no, we have the nice thing about being a primary care doctor is that patients come back. And so we can see each other every 3 to 4 months, and it's an ongoing relationship, hopefully over years.
You write that doctors learn 10,000 new words over the course of their training. How does that affect their ability to communicate with people who don't have this specialized knowledge and vocabulary?
Doctors often forget that much of our terminology isn't real English. We'll say terms like MI, meaning myocardial infarction or heart attack, but forget that patients don't know what an MI is. And we use it so much, it's so ingrained in us that we don't recognize that we're using foreign terminology. So patients may nod as though they're understanding, but really not get what we're saying.
And then so doctors will commonly say that a patient has failed chemotherapy, which sounds like they're blaming the patient. Why not just simply say that the cancer is resistant to chemotherapy?
Or the chemotherapy didn't work, or the chemotherapy failed the patient. And again, this is a lot of the standard way medical histories are written. For example, we'll say a patient denies being short of breath. Sounds like a courtroom drama. They just didn't have shortness of breath, but that's the way we express it in the written medical record.
So are these just bad habits, or do they reveal how doctors think about their patients?
Well, it's somewhat of a cultural issue. There's a whole culture of medicine, including a language, a way of speaking, a way of being, a way of dressing, that we're so acculturated to that we don't recognize that other people don't realize this.
And then there are other problems, I would imagine. Is it better to call a patient obese and risk hurting his feelings, or to say that your weight may be damaging your health and risk being thought of being patronizing?
It's an interesting conundrum. There's some research suggests that although some patients find the term obese insulting, many patients find it more concerning than overweight and makes them more likely to make changes. So I think we have to be careful in how we say it, but some anxiety about the illness helps you make a change.
Can't you just say you're quite overweight and you have to bring it down a bit?
Part of it, I think, is finding for an individual patient what works and getting a sense of what will help them make a change. And using a term like obese can be off-putting to many patients. So I will tend to say, you know, your weight is more than it should be, and it would be helpful for you, for your blood pressure, if your weight came down.
Wording can be really sensitive in all sorts of ways. Aren't some people proud to call themselves cancer survivors while others are uncomfortable with the implications of being a survivor?
So that's it. Again, some of these have political overtones, and I tend to try be as neutral as possible. A patient who has had cancer is what I'll say. And if they say cancer survivor, then I'll use that term and kind of match their level.
Since doctors are trained to scope out the chief complaint, what are the challenges of treating a patient who has a number of different symptoms that may or may not be related?
So the patient who comes in with 20 or 30 complaints is a very big challenge because one of them may be critically important and many may not be. What I'll often say to a patient is, you know, you have lots on your mind. we can't realistically hit them all. Let's pick the top three. You pick two and I'll pick one. So I make sure that I find the one on the list that I think is the most life-threatening that I want to make sure we're addressed, and the patient picks their priorities as well.
You write about Morgan Amanda Fritzlin. She had 26 separate diagnoses.
She was an unusual a patient who had some many legitimate and quite rare illnesses. And I think she would be an unusual outlier in that sense. But she was a patient, very intelligent woman. She's part of how I came to write the book. I had the unique opportunity to interview her as well as her physician and hear them both tell the story of the same events. And I was fascinated that the stories were quite different. It was like a movie scene with two different cameras. Even though both were very thoughtful, self-reflective, yet they saw things very differently.
Well, who was closer to accurate?
I mean, having not been there, I can't say. I think they were both accurate. I think ultimately that was my lesson, that both stories were accurate. They both contained elements of truth, and that pulling it together and finding where the miscommunications happened is part of what makes the best medical care.
You report that doctors didn't want to treat her. Was her case just seen as simply too complex?
Well, certainly patients with very complicated illnesses, many patients are nervous about taking them on. You still get the same 15 minutes. They don't expand your time from a sicker patient. And when conditions are very time intensive, it can be a little off-putting.
Well, like many educated long-time patients, Morgan Amanda was very well read on her condition. And today, I'd imagine doctors have to contend with the fact that people go online and suddenly are self-diagnosing, perhaps accurately, sometimes inaccurately. Do many doctors find those kinds of patients difficult and opinionate?
It's a double-edged sword. So if patients who come in with some knowledge can be very helpful to make the treatment of the illness, you know, move a little more efficiently. But sometimes patients will come in with lots of misinformation. It's very hard to distinguish on the web what's accurate, what's not. And some patients will come in with a 3-foot stack of materials thinking that we can go through them all, which just is not realistic.
On the other hand, patients now feel a bit better about not having doctors act like they are gods.
Right. I think that no one in the room is God. And you know, it is a team sport. But it doesn't mean that doctors should abandon their role of being an advocate and giving, if they have an honest opinion about one treatment versus another, we should express that, not say, well, you just decide for yourself. That's not really, you know, being an advocate.
Despite good intentions on the part of both patient and doctor, don't they have to stop working together sometimes?
In the sense of when they have to part ways if they have disagreements?
Well, yeah. Well, one of them has to wind up having the final say.
I mean, hopefully you're able to
Like Morgan Amanda left her doctor.
Right. So it may be that some people need to find a different doctor who works on their wavelength. But I think usually you can come to an agreement that represents, you know, both of your priorities in there.
My guest is Danielle Ofri. Her latest book is What Patients Say, What Doctors Hear. It is published by Beacon Press. And we'll talk more with Dr. Ofri after we take a little break. Stay with us. And we're back with Dr. Danielle Ofri. Her latest book, What Patients Say, What Doctors Hear, it is published by Beacon Press. What are some of the challenges you've encountered while treating your patients at Bellevue?
Well, Bellevue is a wonderful and interesting hospital. We have patients from all over the world. So one challenge is language. This morning I had a patient who spoke Burmese, and I was trying to track down a Burmese interpreter by phone, which turned out not to be possible. So I had to use a relative. So there are language challenges. There's often socioeconomic issues that may add into it.
They're uninsured often, indigent.
Some are uninsured, some are indigent. Many are working in jobs that don't provide insurance. And many certainly right now are very nervous about the issue with immigrants and immigration and the repeal of ACA. It affects them directly.
And what about the initial image that you have? A patient walks in and is very seriously overweight, is obese. It's my sense that some doctors kind of have a bias against them.
I think all people have biases, and certainly doctors are no exception. our challenge is to try and do a blank slate as much as possible, because we tend to look at obesity as self-inflicted and maybe this patient just isn't working hard enough, and to try and take that part out because it doesn't really help us achieve our goal of helping this patient get better health.
Tell us about the Canadian study for the treatment of back pain.
This was a fascinating study to me. I mean, this is a study in which patients went for physical therapy and they received electrical stimulation, a very common treatment. But for half the patients, the machine was never turned on, called sham treatment. And those patients with a fake machine actually had a 25% reduction in pain relief.
If they turn the placebo effect.
It works quite nicely. When they turn the machine on, they have a 45% reduction in pain. So the machine actually works. But then they further divided the groups, and half the physical therapists were absolutely silent, and some, the other half, were engaged, talking to the patients about their pain, how it's affecting their life, how they might get better, being optimistic, being encouraging. And the patients who had engaged physical therapists but with the machine completely off had a 55% reduction in pain, more than the machine alone.
But I know that as a potential patient, if I was told that I had been given a placebo, I would be really upset.
Interestingly, a lot of patients aren't. Ted Kapchuk up at Harvard in the placebo studies program, he did an experiment with patients with irritable bowel syndrome where he gave them a placebo and said, this is a placebo, but research shows that placebos help relieve pain, and a significant amount had improved pain. And one of my patients once said, I don't care if it's a dill pickle. If it relieves my pain, I'm happy to have it. And certainly placebos have many fewer side effects.
But the placebo also suggests that this is in our heads. It's not really a truly physical condition.
Not quite, because the placebo effect does activate things in our bodies, endorphins, cortisol levels. When we do studies with placebos and patients are using MRIs of their brain, we can see areas light up of the pain areas, even with just placebos and communication.
How do you respond when patients ask if a multivitamin will give them more energy?
It's a funny thing. You know, in the past, I would always say, you know, it's a waste of money, waste of time, unless you have a vitamin deficiency. But now that I've read the research, I will say, you know, many of my patients have said that they get much more energy with a multivitamin. It's worth a try because there's not much downside. And inevitably, a few patients come back and feel better.
Is that the placebo effect?
I believe so. And if I'm not replacing another required medication, and if it helps them, I think it's actually a very helpful, legitimate medical intervention.
I'm sure that when you read the medical journals and see what the latest research reveals, you think back to a time when you were told the exact opposite in treating patients.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, take estrogen. We used to always prescribe estrogen to, you know, prevent heart disease, and then we stopped prescribing because now it causes heart disease. So we're constantly having to, you know, rethink how we explain to patients.
Diseases like diabetes and hypertension require patient participation to take their medication regularly and to control their diets. Why is adhering to a medical plan often so difficult for people? I can imagine that stabbing yourself with a needle if you have diabetes might be something you might prefer not to do.
Well, there are many reasons. Many of the pills cause a lot of side effects. They can make people nauseous, have diarrhea, affect their sexual function. The medications can be, as we mentioned, prohibitively expensive. They can be embarrassed to use their syringe in public. There may be family pressures to not be taking pills. So there are many, many reasons. And often doctors say, are you taking your meds? And patients will say, yeah. But if we say, you know, a lot of patients sometimes have trouble taking medications. Do you ever have trouble taking yours? The patient might be more likely to reveal difficulties in taking the medication.
And I always wonder about those commercials on television where after they show you these happy people, they then say, if you have some illness, do not do it, or this might lead to suicidal thoughts. Or I would imagine that a lot of people would be afraid to take those medications. Do they come to you and ask you for them after they've seen the ads on television?
Yes, in fact, both responses. So one, if people come and say, I saw this on TV, you know, can I get this? Or I heard about these horrible side effects. I never want to take this, but I'll take these supplements. And I try to make the case that all things you put in your body, vitamins, supplements, or medications, all have side effects, and do the risks, you know, outweigh the benefits.
Do patients prefer to get written instructions that they can take home with them?
I think it should be both. Written is very helpful. The medication list, you know, writing down the next three appointments, as well as reiterating verbally the three most important points of the visit.
Then there's always the matter of, oh, I was supposed to take that pill at 7 o'clock. I forgot. Should I take it now? It's 11.
Right. It's very difficult. I mean, we send home patients with multiple medications. I used to do an experiment with my medical students, have them write prescriptions, and then we would give out boxes of Tic Tacs and give them each 3 prescriptions to take for a week, and not one could do it. And they realized that it's very hard to take a twice-a-day medication, 3 times a day medication, one without meds, one with meals. It's very hard to do.
How do doctors deal with their discomfort at having to deliver bad news?
Nobody wants to deliver bad news. I mean, to tell someone that you have a serious disease, you might die or you will die, that's a very just humanly difficult thing. And often the reaction of doctors, maybe unconsciously, is we try to get it over as fast as possible and jump right onto the plan. Well, here are the X things to do, whereas the patient has stopped listening. Once you've said cancer or stroke, they don't hear anything.
Because they need time to process what
I think our brain
heard.
Often shuts down once we hear this terrible news.
As a result, don't patients often fail to absorb any information after they've heard the bad
That's
news?
A very, very common reaction. So we suggest for doctors to give enough time for the diagnosis part before the plan and to make sure the patient has enough time to absorb it, understand it, before you go on to the 16 things that happen next.
When a patient asks, how much time do I have left? Doctors tend to respond with statistics and averages. That doesn't always satisfy.
Not at all, because it doesn't help that individual patient. Now, the truth is, doctors and medical science were terrible prognosticators. Our data will give us 5-year averages, but doesn't tell us what will happen for you, the one single person. So I try to give patients a range and then maybe offer something like, I think we should hope for the best, but also plan for the worst. So let's keep both possibilities in mind. So no one gets surprised if an illness starts to progress more rapidly than we'd expected.
You tell a story in the book about how early in your career you made an error when you failed to read a CT scan. What happened to the patient?
So this was a patient admitted when I was a resident at Bellevue. This was during the height of the AIDS epidemic, and it was very, very busy. And so one of the things we tried to do to survive the multiple admissions is to kind of transfer patients as quickly as possible. In the middle of the night, we got an elderly gentleman with, quote, altered mental status. You know, a guy from a nursing home, a little more demented, and his labs were fine, radiology fine. So I quickly tried to turf this guy to a holding unit, just get him back to his nursing home. And I told the doctor, just take him quickly. He's fine. Labs fine. Radiology fine. Turns out the next day that, in fact, he was bleeding in his head. And I'd missed it because I hadn't read the CAT scan. Somebody had said radiology fine, and I didn't read the scan myself. Now, luckily, someone else saw the scan. The patient got taken to the OR and was treated fine. So, in fact, the patient's care was not impacted. So this was a near-miss error. Yet I had still made the error. Had I sent the patient home, they could have been dead.
And then doctors sometimes dismiss things. A friend of mine had a pain in his back, and the doctor said, you just have to do some exercises. He also happened to go to a chiropractor who said, no, I'm feeling something here. He went back to his doctor. The doctor said, you should change chiropractors, after he sent him to another doctor who agreed that it was just normal back pain. The second chiropractor said, no, I think the first chiropractor was right. They did x-rays or CAT scans or whatever, and it turned out he had a serious cancer. And if he had not gone to the chiropractor, who chiropractors are dismissed by most mainstream medicine, he'd be dead.
I mean, you point out it's often very difficult to make a diagnosis like that. I mean, everyone has back pain, and maybe 0.5% will have back pain from a cancer. So picking that out, in short of doing a CAT scan on every single person, which is not realistic, can be difficult. So that's where asking the story very clearly, trying to distinguish the very subtle distinctions between the back pain caused by cancer and that by muscle strain can be teased out.
You never told your supervisor about your error.
No, because I was just too embarrassed. I was humiliated. I had not done due diligence for my patient. And I know why I didn't. I was too ashamed. But I look back now and think, what a missed opportunity to have my supervisor educate me on how not to make the error, how to talk to a patient about a mistake. Yet I was just not, could not bring myself to come forward.
Do hospitals accept that a certain number of lawsuits are going to be part of the cost of doing business?
Well, the goal is to minimize them as much as possible. And I think now we're moving much more toward transparency, to being honest with patients. But You know, we can make laws and protocols, but if we don't address the shame and embarrassment, it's hard for people to come forward.
What are the most common reasons patients sue their doctors? You write about a Mrs. Benson, a woman whose husband died because of a medical error.
So if you look at the data, most patients ultimately are suing over information issues. They feel they did not know what was going on. And only a small percentage is the true malpractice that we think of, the thing that was done incorrectly, because doctors often clam up, understandably perhaps. But in this case, the patient had a central line, a big IV line put in their neck, and puncturing the lung is a rare but known complication. This happened, and it was a dreadful, you know, conflagration of events. The patient died. But for the wife, no one told her what happened, and that is what made her so upset and angry. And until someone acknowledged that the doctor not only knew about the error and felt grievously terrible about it, and it haunted him every day, that she understood that he felt that, could she have any sort of peace?
And doctors complain that that insurance is one of the biggest things they have to deal with. So how do you get past that? What's the goal of an organization like Sorry Works?
So Sorry Works is an organization that was pointing out that when doctors do come forward with errors, then in fact patients are much less likely to sue. And it has definitely been shown, because again, most patients want to know what happened. And if you explain to patients, here's what happened, here was the error, here's what we're doing to make sure it doesn't happen again, most patients don't want to go through a lawsuit. It's horrible for patients as it is for doctors.
Doctors also complain that fear of lawsuits is a reason that they have patients go through many more tests than they might need.
It's defensive medicine's become an inordinate source of expense. We overorder CAT scans or MRIs for every patient with back pain, because if we miss the one with cancer, we will be sued. And again, if we spend a little more time listening to the patient, we might be able to A, avoid unnecessary tests, but B, if an error happens, the patient's much more likely to understand and accept the reasoning behind it and probably less likely to sue.
Bellevue is a public hospital that serves a disproportionately low-income and immigrant patient population. What kind of impact do you think initiatives like the repeal of the Affordable Care Act and the refugee ban will have on your patients and general practice there?
So our patients are very worried, if not for themselves, then for their family members. It's a big concern, and I think it also makes patients a little more fearful of going to the doctor and leaving things and, you know, to the last minute. Because preventative care really makes a difference. We want our patients to come on a regular basis and not be afraid to come, but many are concerned they might lose their coverage.
What advice would you give to a patient who senses that her doctor isn't being responsive?
So one thing, it's okay to say, like if a doctor is busy typing, not listening, you could say, hey, could you give me a minute to get my story out? I know you have a lot to do, but just give me 1 minute and I'll get it all out. And I think most doctors are willing to stop what they're doing and pay attention.
But then is it reasonable for someone to say, you know, I really want a different doctor?
That's, if your doctor really isn't listening, you should get another doctor. There's enough out there.
Can empathy and communication skills be taught at medical school?
I believe they can be taught. How they can't be taught is, you know, our typical medical education with a PowerPoint presentation and an exam on this. How it's really taught is really almost one-on-one or small group with a physician who goes to the bedside and shows how best to talk with the patient, how to deal with a difficult patient, how to break bad news, and seeing it in real time. And we can learn this not just from other doctors, but from nurses, from physical therapists, from nutritionists who spend a lot of time with patients.
Often the people who've gone through some kind of a clinic or emergency room remember the names of the nurses, but they don't remember the names of the doctor.
Probably because nurses spend much more time with patients. They also spend more time touching the patients, whereas doctors, we stand back and cross our arms and talk from a distance. Nurses are much closer to their patients.
In the old days, doctors made house calls, and so we had a very different feeling of our relationship with them. They, in some cases, they were people we felt we knew.
Indeed. There is some
resurgence.
You think
something's been lost?
I do believe so. There's a resurgence in house calls, but the whole idea of primary care medicine, I mean, I have a few patients at Bellevue, been my patients for 20 years, and we know each other very well, and I feel as though because we know each other that if my patient comes in and something's wrong, I can pick it up quite quickly because I know him by now.
Do you what response have you been getting from this book? Do doctors read it and say, right on, or do they say, oh, Danielle, you shouldn't have revealed that?
Well, certainly patients. It resonates a lot with patients because the idea of not being heard is such a common complaint and a big fear. And the truth is most doctors recognize that communication is very difficult and wish they weren't forced to multitask so much so they could listen more.
You'll be signing books and talking tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at the Barnes & Noble store on 82nd Street and Broadway. I'm assuming some of your former patients will show up.
Maybe some, and some staff and other friends.
Meanwhile, if you want to read this book, which is just fascinating, it's What Patients Say, What Doctors Hear from Beacon Press. My great thanks to Dr. Danielle Ofri for being on our show again. It's always a pleasure to see you, even though some of the things you reveal can be a little scary at times.
Thank you, Leonard.
What makes something go viral? How does an idea, product, or person go from relative obscurity to cultural icon status? Derek Thompson, a senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly, doesn't believe that kind of popularity happens by accident. In his new book, Hitmakers, The Science of Popularity in an Age of Distraction, he uses science to analyze hits across time and reveals how each success story has a secret history that helped us turn it into a phenomenon. His book is published by Penguin Press, and I'm very pleased it has brought Derek Thompson to our show today. Hello.
Hey, it's great to be here.
You write in your introduction about the lullaby your mother used to sing to you when you were she wanted you to go to sleep. What was it?
It was Brahms' Lullaby.
Da, da, she da, wasn't the only da, mother da, who sang that.
Da, 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 da. Right. Oh, no. I think there are millions of mothers around the world that are deeply familiar with this tune, and many children, therefore, as well.
But you thought it was something she'd composed?
I did. Yeah, for a long time, I think it's only natural to think that, you know, a song that your mother is singing to you is something that she wrote. And so, yeah, I did not know the provenance of this particular lullaby.
Now, Brahms wrote an awful lot of major symphonic works, but did he write this very much with the idea of writing a hit tune?
No. He wrote it for a single mother named Bertha. He had fallen in love with a soprano in Vienna when he was younger. And when she finally married another man and named their first son Johannes, he wanted to write a lullaby that she could sing to her son that could sort of cheekily also be a love song that she was singing in a far-flung way to him. And that's why he wrote the lullaby.
So how did it wind up becoming one of the most familiar tunes in the world?
So he borrowed a tune that Bertha had sung to him. It was a famous folk song. And Brahms was a bit of a cheeky customer. He would travel around Europe and he would go to lullabies and he would look at go to libraries and look at the sheet music of some of the most famous folk songs. And he would basically steal the most interesting parts of those songs so he could incorporate them into his music. It's a bit like, you know, how George Lucas wrote Star Wars in a way. He took his favorite bits of all his favorite stories and threw it into one. And so when it finally arrived in Vienna, when it was finally performed, a lot of people recognized the tune.
So he understood the importance of familiarity.
Exactly.
Is familiarity a really important factor in what you're discussing here?
Familiarity might be the most important
factor. It doesn't
factor.
Breed contempt, actually?
No.
Breeds memory.
It breeds memory. It breeds liking. We like that which is familiar, and we particularly like that which is sneakily familiar. We don't want to hear the same song 17 times in a row, but we love hearing a new song with an old chord structure once, twice, three times in a row.
What role have media played in shaping entertainment in Brahms' day? How would something like this lullaby have been launched?
Something like this would have been launched in a concert hall. You would have played it for 1,000 people at once. There was no radio technology in the 1800s to distribute this sort of thing around the world. And as a result, hit music took forever to travel. It took 20, 30 years for Beethoven's most famous symphonies to reach New York City and Boston. It's fun to imagine sort of the same thing happening with cultural products today. It taking, you know, 20 years for Seinfeld to reach London. They would be just learning who Jerry Seinfeld is today. So hits traveled very slowly in the 1800s.
But even during my lifetime, hits have traveled differently. Began with, I guess, AM radio, then moved to FM, and then to TV, and now the internet maybe I've left out a couple of things.
Well, I think in many ways the long story of media technology briefly told is that we built a couple of broadcast technologies that could reach mass audiences, but only a few organizations owned those technologies in the middle of the 20th century. So broadcasting power was aristocratic, I guess you could say. Only a few people could reach tens of millions. But now broadcasting power has democratized. There are podcasts that reach many millions, newsletters that reach many millions, Facebook accounts that reach many millions. And so broadcast power has democratized, and it has changed the way that hits are made.
And also the way we purchase the hit. For example, if I'd heard a record that I liked on an AM show when I was a kid, I then had to remember, write down the name, remember it, go to the record store, and hope that they had a 45 of it.
Right.
Now you can just click and get the thing immediately into your computer.
It's frictionless. It's beautiful. It's beautiful for consumers. But what is it like for artists? What is it like when you don't have that one AM or FM radio station that you know will reach your target audience, and you think, well, maybe I reach them on Twitter, maybe on Spotify, maybe through WNYC? It is much more difficult to find the optimal way to reach your target demographic.
So are the gatekeepers more important than the artists in the end?
Well, it's interesting because the gatekeepers used to be few and they used to have all of the power. Record companies, for example, used to be able to dictate tastes in a very clear way. You had payola, where the record labels would literally pay the radio DJs to play their favorite songs, say, you know, play the Rolling Stones over and over again.
I came along too late.
And by sheer familiarity, they would fall in love with that Rolling Stones song. And they also could tell the record store owners to tell Billboard that certain songs were selling the fastest, so those songs would soar up the Billboard charts. But now, hits seem to come more from the bottom. So if you're a record company and you're trying to make a song go quote-unquote viral, make it go really, really big at once, you can't dictate taste from the top. You're more likely to have a successful song if you can find, say, a meme that you can attach the song to that emerges from the public.
And in many cases, the artists are doing it themselves. They have become artists and impresarios at the same time.
Yeah, one interesting thing that's happening in Hollywood and in music both is that artists are realizing that they can become their own studios, their own labels. You have, you know, Nicole Kidman and Michael B. Jordan starting their own production companies in Hollywood. You have some musicians essentially saying, I'm famous enough that I don't need a label. And so it's exciting, I think, for new artists to imagine that they don't need these old gatekeepers to achieve popularity. They might be able to build it from the ground up.
You write about Justin Bieber's influence on the fate of a song called Call Me Maybe.
I do. Yeah, one of my favorite pop songs of the century, I guess, is Call Me Maybe, ubiquitous several years ago. But what's really interesting about Call Me Maybe as an example of some of the ideas we've talked about is that Call Me Maybe was not a particularly popular song for a long time, even though when you hear it, it sometimes sounds inherently infectious and contagious. But Justin Bieber, the ubiquitous Canadian pop star, put it out on YouTube and tweeted it out to his followers, and that served essentially as a broadcast moment. Many millions of people discovered the song because Justin Bieber gave it his imprimatur. So right there, I think, we have a lovely example of how many decades ago, AM and FM had a monopoly on broadcast exposure. But now, Justin Bieber is a radio station. He has the power to make hits all by himself.
So if you have followers on Twitter or Instagram or whatever, you can automatically reach a lot of people right from the start. On the other hand, does the variety of available technology also make it more difficult to get someone's attention?
I think that both these things are happening at the same time, that it's not a paradox. They're simply living with each other. That on the one hand, because broadcast technology has democratized, you have many more people who can essentially reach thousands or millions at once. But this is also, though, how popularity is built. It is built through broadcast. So if you have a new product and you want to get it out there, one of the most important things you can do after designing for familiarity is to find those perfect broadcasts to reach your audience.
My guest is Derek Thompson, whose book is Hitmakers, The Science of Popularity in an Age of Distraction. It's published by Penguin Books. This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, the Super Bowl seems to me to be the perfect example of the old school approach. Mm-hmm. But you reach millions and millions of people, and I assume that's why the ads are so expensive. But I don't. What kind of impact would it have had on Lady Gaga? She's already a superstar. Do you think her record sales go up as a result of that appearance?
I know that her record sales have gone up as a result of that appearance. The Super Bowl is unlike anything else that exists right now because, exactly as you said, it is an old-fashioned, truly mass media broadcast. Think of it this way. The biggest movie of 2016, Rogue One, the Star Wars film, sold 55 million tickets in the U.S. 110 million people watched the Super Bowl, according to the most conservative estimates. So the Super Bowl was twice as popular as the most popular blockbuster of 2016. It is like a Kilimanjaro over the Serengeti landscape. It doesn't have any equal. And as a result, you have all of these companies recognizing that it is a unique way to reach all of the United States at once in an age of fragmentation.
But then they have to pay $5 million for a 30-second commercial.
Yes.
And every car in the world is advertising during the Super Bowl. Aren't they canceling each other out?
And this is the paradox of the Super Bowl. It is that it is because it is so obviously a broadcast unlike any other broadcast that every major company that can afford $5 million for a 30-second spot advertises in it, and often they cancel each other out. If Coca-Cola and Pepsi both spend their many, many millions of dollars, often they don't move market share. Here's why the Super Bowl, though, is still the king of media. Because if you're a new product, if you're a new app or a new a website or a new movie or artist, then it really has the potential to give you breakout success.
So it can sell a movie better than it can a bowl of soup.
Yes. Well, if that bowl of soup is the only bowl of soup that is advertising in the Super Bowl, then it will probably eke out a bit of market share. But movies, we absolutely know, and musicians clearly benefit tremendously from Super Bowl exposure.
Well, they also are all aiming at coming up with viral ads. Budweiser has a history of them. But there were, after the Super Bowl, we start reading about which ads went viral. Does viral mean success or does it just mean attention?
Well, I have a chapter in the book called The Viral Myth, where I argue that virality, in the way that we imagine it, doesn't really exist. I think most people think of viral ideas spreading like viral diseases. I get sick, I get you sick, you get two other people sick, and it spreads through many, many, many generations of intimate shares. But information spreads in a very different way. Almost all information that goes big has one extremely important or several extremely important broadcast moments, not a million one-to-one shares, but a few one-to-one million shares. And so for this reason, when something goes big in the Super Bowl, I don't think it makes sense to think of it as a viral disease because there's no disease that gets 110 million sick in a single hour. This is what we should call broadcasts, not viruses.
Someone sends, a service sends broadcasters all sorts of information every day, and that includes which thing went viral online. Today it was a cat that was climbing around a tree trying to get something out of a birdcage.
It sounds very adorable.
So are there still gatekeepers and opinion makers in the viral world? I mean, how does that suddenly go viral? Who suddenly decides that that's something that should excite everybody? A cat? The cat's real cute, but so.
Right, right. So here's where data scientists can be really, really useful, is in answering a question just like this. How did a video that seems to have come out of nowhere really come out of nowhere? And what they've done is to look at the spread of so-called viral videos. And again, if it truly spreads like a virus, we should see many, many, many generations of one to two sharing. But instead, what they see is a blast moment, several 1 to 1 million moments. So going back to your example, think about what you said. You said, I was looking at a newsletter that was telling me what the viral things were. That newsletter is a broadcast. It's not a viral mechanism. It's a broadcast. It's a newspaper. It's telling you what's popular. And if you have many different organizations focused on telling people what the most interesting new video is, what the cutest new cat is doing, then you essentially have many broadcasters interested in cat content. And that is how those videos are going viral, is because they are being broadcast.
You have a chapter on the way people respond to art, and it reminded me that that when you go to the Louvre, where there are so many great paintings, it doesn't really matter. There is just a huge crowd around the Mona Lisa. So has the Mona Lisa gone viral in a way? Is that something that went viral 100 years ago?
Well, the story of the Mona Lisa is absolutely beautiful. A lot of people think of the Mona Lisa as the pinnacle, the apotheosis of beautiful painting. It is the most valuable painting in the world in terms of its insurance costs.
Because it was stolen once?
But yeah, for a long time, it was not the most valuable painting, even in its own museum. But it was stolen by an Italian around the turn of the century. This theft became an international scandal covered by many newspapers, broadcasters, and it was the scandal of the stealing of the Mona Lisa that made it this international hit. After it was returned to France, it then went on a national tour as if it were the Rolling Stones. It went to Washington, D.C., and New York City, and London, and everyone got to gawk at this painting that had been stolen and almost lost from the world. And that is why it was mimicked so often by 20th century artists, and that's why we recognize it when we see it everywhere. So it, too, benefited from a historical accident that elevated its popularity, and B, a sequence of broadcast moments that told the world that this was a painting unlike other paintings.
In art or in music or in the arts in general, how important are changing tastes? For example, a book will become a bestseller and then 20 years later nobody will remember it. Or I was thinking about Caravaggio and Vermeer, who were famous in their day and then forgotten for centuries and then suddenly became important again, both of them considered two of the greatest painters in the history of the world, changing tastes.
I'm completely fascinated by changing tastes, by fashions, and by canons, because in a way what you're talking about is fame and canons and, you know, in literature and art. The first chapter of the book tells the story of the Impressionist canon. Why is it that if all of these Impressionist painters were equally hated in the 1870s, that we think only a handful of them are absolute geniuses in the 2010s?
Because some were better than others? Isn't quality a factor? Isn't Monet better than Sisley?
I don't know how you'd prove it
Pissarro?
I don't know how you'd prove it quantitatively, but let's just say that in the 1870s, Monet was not necessarily considered by all people to be that much better than someone like Gustave Caillebotte, who is now relatively obscure. But what happened is that Gustave Caillebotte, this relatively obscure and independently wealthy Impressionist painter, collected a bunch of his friends' paintings while he was living, died prematurely in 1890, bequeathed his collection to the French Museum, created with this bequest the first Impressionist exhibit in a French state museum in history. And who were the painters in that collection? Manet, Monet, Renoir, Degas, Cezanne, Pissarro, and Sisley. Still the core seven Impressionist painters, the canon. He just happened accidentally to have collected all seven. I don't think that Caillebotte necessarily had the greatest taste in the world. He was specifically buying paintings that wouldn't sell to other buyers.
So who was lost?
What happened? Who was lost?
Yeah, I'm trying to think of the...
Morisot, you could say. Morisot was lost. You could say that Caillebotte himself was lost because he didn't give himself the gift of exposure. So people who go to the Chicago Art Institute and can see Paris Rainy Day, which is an absolutely gorgeous piece of art that's famous in Chicago, nonetheless don't recognize the name of the painter underneath it. When I was reporting the book, I went to the National Art Gallery in Washington, D.C., and they had an exhibit for Gustave Caillebotte. And they said right there on the placard next to the exhibit, they said, He is probably the least known of the Impressionist painters, but how beautifully ironic that the least known Impressionist painters was the one who created the canon by buying all of these, all of his friends' best works and bequeathing them to a state government that could essentially give the imprimatur of public consecration to make these works famous.
So an exhibit can set the tone, as we saw in New York with the Armory Show, that pretty much set the taste for modern art in America for decades to follow. We have to take a little break. Okay. We'll come back to that and other things. My guest is Derek Thompson. His book, Hitmakers, The Science of Popularity in an Age of Distraction, is published by Penguin Press. Stay with us for more. We're back with Derek Thompson. His book, Hitmakers, The Science of Popularity in an Age of Distraction, is published by Penguin Press. A little more on art before we move on to some other things. Can we say that galleries and museums are the radio stations of the art world?
Yeah, I really...
But galleries are going through real bad times nowadays, and art fairs have become the big thing.
Yeah, I think that museums, in many ways, were the original television channel. They were the original radio station, the original Facebook news feed, the first place, other than maybe the Greek amphitheater, where the public could come to look at a collection, a bundle of art, a bundle of artistic works. And because they had the power of exposure and the power of public consecration to tell audiences, this is what matters, this is what's good, they had the power to create stars the same way that today's channels of broadcast exposure do.
How does this apply to political campaigns?
Well, I think we're living in a world right now where you simply can't ignore the power of exposure. If you look at how Donald Trump so dominated the Republican primary to win the nomination of a party that did not want him to be their nominee for the vast, vast majority. I'm talking about the political operatives, did not want him to be their representative. This is a perfect representation of our bottom-up world of hits. Just as in music, where, as we've seen, since the early 1990s, the music labels have lost the ability to dictate hits, and we've seen that that music styles that they weren't always paying to promote, like hip-hop and country, have flown up the charts. Tastes in music have been bottom-up. The same thing is happening in politics. The elites used to be able to decide on their nominees and dictate those tastes through television and radio, but now the people have more power, and they can decide on their populist heroes even when the elites hate them.
So are political campaigns now just another form of entertainment and of hit production? Are political campaigns basically arms of media companies?
Politics as entertainment is the cliche, but I think the truth is probably one letter different. Politics is entertainment, and it has been entertainment for much longer than we would like to think. We think that 1960 was the first television election. Nope. Dwight Eisenhower in 1956 hired TV stars to make his Republican National Convention the glitziest thing in the world. Once you're elected as a representative today, you probably spend 70% of your time telemarketing. A third of the people who work in the White House, not just this White House, White Houses before, are employed in some aspect of PR. So you can think of the White House as a movie studio, as the with the president as its star and these PR people as the means of distributing the president's message. Politics is entertainment.
And how does that apply to the people who talk about politics? If we were following the logic of your argument, cable and the internet would have diminished the power of political commentators, but Rush Limbaugh, Bill O'Reilly are still very influential.
Incredibly influential. And you've seen the power shift over time from broadcast networks to cable networks and then to talk radio. And now you see, I think, a resurgence of interest in what's happening on CNN versus Fox News as the one channel that the president has singled out as fake news versus another channel that some people accuse as essentially being Trump's Pravda. So I think that, yes, over time, as technology changes the distribution of information, the locus of power changes. But right now, I think we are truly seeing Not only a president who sees himself as essentially a media company, but now a news ecosystem that sees itself as having to broadcast challenging messages against the White House. So, I mean, right now, I think that the theme of politics is entertainment has never been more true.
Well, things do shift. Trump once called CNN his personal booker.
He did, yeah.
And now he calls it fake news. But we have, the Times had an article about a guy who created a bunch of fake news stories. They went viral on the internet. To some degree, I suspect they went viral because people wanted to believe them, even though some of them were absolutely crazy and outrageous. And you have something like Alex Jones, who believes every conspiracy possible, some of them so totally unbelievable that it's hard that to imagine anybody would want to listen to him. And yet, he's very popular and very influential.
Absolutely.
Is it that we sometimes gravitate to what we want to hear, want to see?
Oh, of course. Familiarity is powerful not only in music and movies, but incredibly powerful in political journalism. So many readers and listeners and viewers just want to know that their prior biases are true, and they want new and interesting ways to think about the biases they've already come to. But let me just tell a brief story to give people a sense that this is not a new phenomenon. In the 1920s, George Gallup, that Gallup, the famous for Gallup polling, was a dissertation student who wanted to know, what do people read when they open up a newspaper? And he went to Iowans' homes. He was at the University of Iowa, and he watched them read the newspaper and figured out what the most popular bits were. People said they read the front page. They said they wanted to read news.
But they read the funnies first.
But they read the funnies first, and the women looked at the fashion photos. The most popular part of the paper was J.H. Darling's political cartoon. We have been Facebook readers for long, long before there was a Facebook to read. So there is an element, people should be dispirited by how conservative our opinions are, but technology has merely changed the way that we find information we've wanted to believe.
What do you mean by the phrase sneakily recognizable?
I think that one of the most important ideas from the book is that people want familiarity from pop culture.
So is that why movie sequels seem to do better than you might expect?
90% of the time.
Spinoffs on television?
Yep. 90% of the time we listen to music. We're listening to a song we've already heard. Every year this decade, the majority of the top 10 films in America have been sequels, adaptations, or reboots. We want familiarity, but we also want to discover new things. And so the trick for hit makers is essentially, how do I design something that's new, that opens a door to the familiar? And there's this lovely way to think of it that comes from psychology that balances fluency, which is a term for ease of thinking, with disfluency, which means difficulty of thinking. And they said the most beautiful moments of familiarity are those when we confront something that's anxious, and then it opens a door into something that's familiar. And they call it an aesthetic aha. It's a moment that offers this click of meaning. And that click of meaning, I think, is what people are trying to produce across the cultural landscape.
How does the Maya effect relate to that?
Maya, M-A-Y-A, most advanced yet acceptable, was a theory of liking by Raymond Loewy, the father of industrial design in the 1950s. He said people are torn between neophilia, they love new things, and neophobia, they hate new things. And so the trick when designing a car, a train, a pencil sharpener, was to design a product that was clearly new, but that was also sneakily familiar, that was Maya.
I always thought that the reason that we had all those sequels and movies that look like other movies was that the people who fund the movies are afraid of risking their money on something that that might not be a hit, although sometimes the sequels bomb.
Sometimes the sequels bomb, but they are better bets than original films. And that is precisely the risk that they face. They say, all right, well, we know that all original ventures are risky. But what is the least risky original venture? It's an original venture that is a sequel or adaptation of an already successful cultural product. And so that's why you see in movies that the business model in the last 20 years has completely reoriented itself. In 1996... none of the top 10 films were sequels. In 2016, 6 of the top 10 most popular films were sequels. The only exceptions, essentially, were the animated films, the lovely films for families. So clearly the business model of Hollywood has reoriented itself around familiar surprises, the sneaky familiar.
And when people are putting together things that will appeal to kids, do they have any insight into what kids will respond to?
There isn't a lot of research on what appeals to children specifically in the book. But one thing I think is clearly known about kids is that they are even more in love with repetition than adults are. When they find a favorite show, they want to watch it over and over. When they find a favorite song, they want to watch it over and over. Adults are also into repetition of our favorite music and shows, but just not quite as much.
I always wondered why so many vampire movies are popular, movies about the living dead. Is it because we've seen others? What kinds of antecedents did the Star Wars movies have that made them feel new and old all at the same time?
George Lucas originally didn't want to write Star Wars. He wanted to produce a movie called Flash Gordon that was based on one of his favorite comics. But the owner of the comic turned him down. And so he essentially said, all right, if I can't make my favorite comic, I'll make something that's just like it, that is a kind of Sunday. I'm going to take bits of my favorite parts from all my favorite comics, and I'm going to combine them in one beautiful dessert that's made essentially for 10 and 11-year-old boys. And I'm just going to make it a bunch of things that I like. And so in a way, what Lucas did with Star Wars that I think made it so brilliant is that it is cliches. But it's a bunch of cliches reorganizing themselves in ways that they had never been reorganized. A bundle of previously unbundled illusions, and that is what makes it original.
We talked about how Top 40 Radio once sold records, but movies also sold records. And you tell the story of Bill Haley's Rock Around the Clock, which was just sitting there. Nobody was paying attention until it was featured in Black Boy Jungle.
That's right. This is one of those stories that I think should teach all journalists to be careful about saying that all outcomes are inevitable. You know, we always like to say, oh, well, of course Donald Trump had to win the presidency. Of course this team had to win the Super Bowl. But we live in a weird probabilistic universe. Rock Around the Clock comes out in 1954. It's the B-side to a song called 18 Women, and it flops. But then a 10-year-old boy named Peter Ford is one of the few thousand people who buys the record. His father is the star of a movie called Blackboard Jungle. This little boy gives the song to the director when he's visiting the house, and the director puts it in the movie Blackboard Jungle. It plays at the beginning, in the middle, at the end, and it is only then, 2 weeks after this movie Blackboard Jungle comes out, a year later, that the song goes number one on Billboard Hot 100 and becomes the second best-selling song of all time.
Now, we've been talking about how scientists approach all of this, but doesn't this also apply to science? Because certain experiments wind up being, and studies wind up being funded, while other ones aren't, even though in retrospect, we sometimes discover that the one that was ignored and couldn't get any money turned out to be the one that was most important.
That's exactly. And what's so interesting is that this bias toward the familiar that we've talked about in movies and music and politics is also an enormous bias in science. Max Planck himself said the reason that some ideas become law is not because they persuade people, but because those who disagree with it at the time eventually die off, and then it becomes law. And so if you're going, but there have been studies that have shown that if you're trying to submit a paper for funding from the NIH, that the best papers, the most interesting, most popular papers, aren't those that are extremely novel, but also not those that are extremely familiar. Instead, they are those that are sneakily familiar, that advance a broadly familiar subject in a specific way.
We have very little time left, but would this be good advice if somebody who's trying to predict the future trends?
Absolutely. I think that we should always look to the familiar to determine what people like, but then also look to broadcasting power, because those who own the biggest broadcasts dictate the future of popularity.
Derek Thompson is a senior editor at The Atlantic magazine. His book, Hitmakers, The Science of Popularity in an Age of Distraction, published by Penguin Press. And Derek, I hope your book goes viral.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to Leonard Lopate Weekend. We'll be back live on the radio on Monday at noon, and be sure to follow us on Twitter at Leonard Lopate or at facebook.com/LeonardLopateWNYC. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.